This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
What Brock Huard says?
No, he's not a friend of mine.
Subscribe to receive every episode at Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts.
Ah, we stink, man.
Now, here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
No way!
Well, here we go with the Brock and Salk podcast. Bruce Feldman to join us later in it to talk some college football in the mixed up, crazy, topsy-turvy world that has become. Hi, buddy. How are you?
I'm doing good. Yeah, I'm doing good. You know what it kind of feels like? Do you remember way back when in the stock market fell and the recession? And I guess we were just kind of getting going as a station. So maybe it preceded some of us. I remember working.
Yeah, that was about a year before we got together.
Yes. And I was working in real estate and working for a development firm. And I actually had a AAA rated, some kind of, you know, financially backed bond that was, that went belly up. In that entire process. And I just remember the emotion, like every day reading, like, what is going to happen to all of these big banks? And I think it was Lewis that wrote the great book. He wrote a bunch of books on Wall Street and the market and everything else. But the massive amount of emotion that played into it. I guess, you know, and I know we're not leading this podcast with it, so I apologize for starting here. But we've had other times, the Penn State, Joe Paterno and Jerry Sandusky, and the emotion around those days and those weeks, and how that story just turns. And oh my gosh, it just gets you, it just grasps you. And obviously college football is my lifeblood, right? I mean, it's what has been a part of my life for decades and decades and decades. And to just emotionally go back and forth through this with every minute and every hour, and people texting me and friends texting me and colleagues texting me and nobody knowing what's going on. It's been a pretty fascinating 7 days.
Are you going to have a job?
I don't know. I may start landscaping. I've wanted to write a little bit. Hopefully we can continue to have a podcast.
I don't know. I mean, part of your value to us in this podcast is that you're a college football analyst for Fox Sports.
Right.
If you're not that, I don't know. Maybe
I'll
look
just
for another partner.
What if it's postponed? What if it's not canceled? What if it's just delayed or postponed?
If you get furloughed but not laid off, then I think we can continue. But if you get straight up laid off, man, I don't know that we can continue this.
Fair enough.
Wow. Your world just collapsing all at once.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm sure you'll turn to us for some sort of lifeblood. I don't know the word, the raft you're searching for. We'll see. No, I don't care that much about college football one way or another, but I'm rooting for you. And obviously I want you to be able to have your season, and we'll talk a little bit more with Bruce about it coming up. No, we should start today, Brock, with the biggest sports news, twin stories, I would say. The Seahawks coming back to start training camp this week, and one of the best sporting events I've ever watched, the PGA Championship over the weekend. How awesome was that? We're going to spend 1 minute on it, and then we're going to get into the Seahawks' top storylines of the year heading into training camp. How awesome was the PGA Championship this weekend?
Pretty darn incredible.
It was amazing.
And those players ramped it up, and you could feel it. Right. You could just feel those majors are just different for those guys. And I had no doubt. I actually got home. We were running some errands. I was like, oh, this is awesome. It's on the West Coast. So it's going to be up till 8 o'clock, you know, or 7 o'clock. It's going to be on late and I'll be just fine. And I had no doubt that is it Morikawa that was going to hit that drive on 15.
Yeah, because it's 16. After 16, what he had done on 14 with the chip in and stuff.
No doubt. It's 16. He was standing over that ball, and I said, he plays a fade anyway. Yep. He's going to set up absolutely perfectly to his eye, and he's going to drive the green right here, and he's going to win the – I turned him on. I said, he's going to win the tournament right here on this hole. And sure enough, lo and behold, he just hits it within 6 feet from 294 yards and just ice cold, man, just ice in his veins and cold-blooded, just beautiful competition.
That was great. In the meantime, did you see all the smack talking going on throughout all, like, a bunch of the players?
You mean Brooks, Brady, Henderson, Koepka?
Well, obviously you got Brooks talking trash constantly to Bryson, but then Rory started talking trash to Brooks.
No, it was Brooks that talked trash about Dustin Johnson the night before.
Yes, and that too. And then Rory called him out for that, said he hadn't won. Like, it's practically the WWE there going on on tour. So, all right. That is a brief aside. That's probably enough for the golf. I could spend the whole day talking about that. I was as locked in. I watched all day. Starting in the morning on ESPN, finishing at 7 o'clock at night on CBS. It was great. After watching a ton on Saturday, Phil Mickelson will be better than anybody who's ever been a golf announcer if and when he decides to do it. He was fantastic.
Oh, he'll have to do it.
Oh, see, you know, there's no reason to take shots. What, you think his gambling debts are going to make him have to do it?
I just said I think he'll...
You think he needs the money?
I think he'll be have to be gainfully employed for a long time.
That's a terrible thing to say.
What? I'm just saying, I think he'll get to do that. And you're right, he was absolutely tremendous. And Kyle and Howdy, I know you both smiled a little bit when Salk said, I could talk about this for hours, because how many different shows did Salk walk in? We've got things laid out. We're going to talk about X, Y, and Z. And he's
for
like,
years,
I could talk about
years.
Yeah, I could.
Deriding the sport of golf and just saying it was a waste of time.
I know.
Just dumping on every person in the world who could even consider liking the sport to only be the one person left. Forcing it down our throats now that we have serious Seahawks stuff to talk about.
You know what? You know what happened? I got old.
You got old.
All right, it's storyline time, Brock, as Seahawks start training camp this week. Real training camp. I know they've started, but like actually practicing-ish?
Hitting. Yeah, I think they're on the field actually getting to do some shells and helmets and actual contact this week.
So with that in mind, as we always do, we have created our Seahawks top five storylines. Now, they're different. You have your five. I have my five. We'll see. I think I've read through them a little bit. There's some similarity, but I think they're very different concepts of how to do a top five storyline. So I think that should provide some value. So here you go. Without further ado, the top five or 10 Seahawks storylines heading into training camp. Brock, you go ahead.
Should I start in I'm going to start in descending order. Is that okay?
Yeah, we're going to go back and forth. We'll go back.
Yeah, let's go back and forth. I'll start at number 5.
Mine are not in order, so go ahead.
I think now is I can look in the rearview mirror a little bit of this off season and all of the unknowns and the pandemic and everything else. This feels a little like that strike shortened year of just from a roster construction standpoint of so much unknown that I think the Seahawks are playing to that in the fact that they have so many 1 year deals, so many guys in contract years. And they're going to have a massive amount of cap space after this season to take care of those that really do flourish. But just look on the back end of their defense. Quentin Dunbar's on a one-year deal. Shaq Griffin wants to get paid and can get paid after this season. Trey Flowers can get paid after this season. Jamal Adams will get paid after this season. Chris Carson on the other side wants to get paid, wants his. So these young players that want their due, that want their generational payday, so many of them on the roster right alongside a ton of just 1 year deals with veteran players, you know, Greg Olsen in the final year of his career, but a Benson Mayoa, Bruce Irvin, Philip Dorsett, Carlos Hyde, equally those guys at the stage of their career, most of them save for Greg Olsen, they want to extend it. They want to show that they still have gas in the tank. So you've got, I mean, right there is 10, 11 guys on one-year deals, you know, 25% of your team that is just hungry to prove they belong. And I, for one, think that's a great place to be.
Well, it's a good place to be, and it's got a negative consequence to it as well. Let's be clear. I mean, that you can look at it positively, and I understand why you do. The flip side is you got a bunch of guys who are hanging on. Right? I mean, at least the latter group, the Olsen, Irvin, Mayoa, Dorsett, I mean, those guys are potentially just hanging on. The NFL didn't reward them with multi-year deals because the NFL didn't think they were worth it. They're like, okay, we'll give you 1 year and see if you still have anything left, but I don't necessarily trust that you do. And those other guys, well, they haven't been taken care of yet. Obviously, Adams, is, I think they're going to. They're going to have to, but yeah, all right, Dunbar's got to prove himself and Carson, et cetera. But there's a reason the Seahawks haven't tried to take care of Chris Carson. They don't trust the injuries. They don't trust a running back, right?
Got to prove it.
Yeah, so I don't know. I kind of look at this and say, yeah, I understand where you're coming from, but...
I mean, you could be dark, dank, and depressed. I'm not going to be in mid-August.
I'm just saying it's a two-sided coin.
I'm positive.
All right, I'll give you one of mine. Top five storylines from each of us for the Seahawks heading into training camp. Mine are probably a little bit more specific. Who is going to be on the field on defense? They have a lot of guys, Brock, who play the same positions, who they all want to get on the field together. They've got three safeties, four linebackers. You got Ugo Amadi, Trey Flowers, bunch of extra pass rushers without any primary ones. Like, how do you get those guys on the field and when?
Mike, they're positionless. Okay, they're just
is that
athletes.
What it's going to be? Are you
no,
going to see
I don't
like
think so.
Seven defensive backs, a linebacker or two, and Jaron Reed?
Yeah, I think someone tweeted me and said, do you see the Seahawks going to a 2-5-4?
They might have to.
How about a 164?
How about a 245? Sounds like soccer. They just start making up combinations of numbers that add up to 11 and throw them out there. Seriously, how do you get all these guys in the field? You've got three safeties. Are they going to play together?
This is what Coach Carroll wrote his book about, okay? It's about competition.
Okay.
Just throw it all out there, and let's see how it all shakes out.
But you've got three safeties that you would like to get on the field, plus Ugo Amadi, right? So you have three or four safeties you want to get on the field. You have no defensive ends. So, like, how do you – are they going to play as much base as they did last year, or will that go away?
Oh, I sure hope not.
They can't, right?
No.
And Pete will make fun, but are they going to play
a lot of
big
people? Maybe the personnel department finally told and dictated to Pete Carroll, like, nope, sorry, not playing base because you're not going to have the personnel to do it. We're just going to bring in a bunch of safeties and a bunch of fast, undersized linebackers, and we're going to run and hit.
Okay.
I guess that would be my answer, Mike. You're going to run and hit. In early downs, there will be still base defense, right? There's going to be still 35%, and you're going to have to stop the run against the 49ers and the Rams in your own division. And even the Cardinals, when they turned their season around in the second half of last year and beat you in your place, they ran the ball down your throat. So you're still going to have base defense with Diggs and Adams playing the safety spot, and we'll see, you know, whether Bruce Irvin's a strong side linebacker and KJ or Bobby, or whether KJ's going to play a little Sam, and you can put Jordan Brooks in there if he can play as a young player. So you're still going to see some traditional base defense, but in your division as well, and in this league that is playing more in space, I think it's savvy to have more safeties, more undersized fast linebackers, more dudes that can run and hit.
All that is true. I just worry that if you try that, you're just going to get run on by the guys in your division, which is something that Pete has always said you've got to take care of first and foremost.
Okay, very fair. That's one each. Can I get to my second point?
Please do.
My second storyline, and I think we will find a lot of agreement on this one. It's going to be hard for me to imagine any rookie contributing in a meaningful way like a DK Metcalf did last year, and like they've had some rookies pop over the last few years. It's hard for me to imagine a rookie, even Jordan Brooks, contributing in tremendously meaningful ways, but I will say the redshirt freshman class is going to be the difference of this team being a 9-win team or an 11-plus win team. That redshirt freshman class of the Blairs and the Amadis and the Colliers and the DKs, if he can continue to even take another step in his career, that is a group that has to carve out legitimate niches, legitimate roles, be difference makers for this team. Because I think we've learned in this league more than anything else, at least I have, is that if you're going to win double-digit games, you have to have enough strength on your roster 25 through 53 to absorb the losses that are going to come. These bodies are not going to be as fully prepared to hit as they have been in years past. Training camp is going to look and feel totally different. They're going to be, I think, some significant injuries throughout as guys try to ramp up quickly. You have to have 25 through 53, and the redshirt freshman class has got to emerge in a big-time way.
Yeah, they did sort of get redshirted last year, unfortunately, other than DK, who played as a true freshman. I mean, essentially, LJ Collier was redshirted. I don't know if it was entirely, you know, for the right reasons, but, you know, I'll let's
give him... It's a self-induced redshirt. He opted to redshirt.
Let's give him the benefit of the doubt and say he was hurt in training camp, never fully got untracked. And now it's up to him to take a complete... And that's the positive view on it. If I was dank, and depressed earlier, I'll choose to be a little positive on LJ Collier and at least hope that what happened was the guy got hurt and that's why we didn't get to see the player that they thought was worth a first-round pick. But I'm with you, man. I don't expect Jack from the kids. From the rookies? Freddie Swain? Like, I don't expect anything from
Daryl Taylor and Alton Robinson want to provide a little pass rush, I'd take it.
Maybe, and that'll
but
be,
I know Taylor's
is Daryl Taylor
right
even
now,
practicing?
No, he's on the non-football injury list.
Right.
How did he get there?
Well, they knew when they drafted him, that's why he slipped, that he had had, broken leg. He'd had surgery this offseason. He slipped. They thought his medicals were all right. He's just not there yet.
He's just not there yet.
But, you know.
Well, and as we've seen, sometimes when you're not there yet, you don't get training camp. The next thing you know, you have LJ Collier's rookie year.
Correct.
So I'm going to assume that every one of the kids they drafted this year isn't going to do squat. Now, maybe Brooks is the exception to that, partly because of the position, et cetera.
Yep.
But yeah, I think LJ Collier stepping up in a big way, Marquise Blair stepping up in a big way would be an enormous boon to where they're
Cody
at.
Cody Barton, Ugo Amadi, DK Metcalf, Ben Burkervin, just carve
I'm not,
out
I'm not assuming
roles.
I don't know how Barton and Burkervin get on the field.
Yeah,
Burkervin's probably not on the roster.
Phil Haynes, just carve out roles.
Yeah, those
as I said last
Christmas
week,
all day.
As I said last Stack. Week when I quoted Mark Schlereth,
really just LJ
Super
Collier.
Bowl teams have starters and then they have legitimate backups. Yeah. I'm not saying that Cody Barton or Ben Burkervin are starters in this league.
I hope
but
not.
Can they be legitimate backups? Because Super Bowl teams have legitimate
that's
backups.
Fine, and maybe they'll be legitimate backups. But they're going to need some of these guys to actually like contribute and play well. And that's where LJ Collier, Marquise Blair are in kind of a different category. Yeah, all right. If Cody Barton has to come in for a game or a few snaps, I hope he doesn't screw it up. But my real hope is that LJ Collier becomes a plus player for them, that Marquise Blair becomes a plus player for them. That would be a true difference maker, and it would help lead to my second point here, second storyline, which is a pretty easy one. Can they rush the quarterback? We've only talked about it ad nauseum the entire offseason, and on paper, the answer is still no, they can't. Not on paper. Now, maybe there's still a move to be made. Broncos got very exciting over the last week. Clay Matthews and Everson Griffin in the mix. Oh, my gosh.
Man, remember how excited we were for Clay Matthews last year? Maybe we weren't.
Right. So, I don't know. I think Griffin might help your pass rush. I think he's got other issues. But, okay, fine. Maybe there is some help coming. But on paper, can they rush the passer? No. So, what are they going to do to change that? Is it LJ Collier having a year that none of us expect? Is it that Bruce Irvin and Benson Mayoa find the fountain of youth and are better than they were when they were here the first time in the prime of their careers? Is it that Jamal Adams and the other guys in the secondary are used more creatively blitzing? Is it that Bobby Wagner, who always has A-plus grades whenever he rushes the quarterback, is more of a force from the linebacker spot and they blitz? I don't know. But you're going to have to do something to affect the quarterback because on paper, anyway, they can't do that.
Have we talked about this at all?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay. Gonna move to the next one.
You're not even gonna date like nothing.
Check
you're
just the box.
Like, yes, there's that, and let's move on. Okay.
No, I just wonder: is Jadeveon Clowney gonna play football in 2020?
Oh,
and that's not my storyline, but that's how I would add to that. I mean, we're getting into this, and remember now when these players come in. If you bring Clay Matthews in or some of these others, they've got to spend like 3 days in testing before they can ever even get into the facility. So as you kind of continue to push this thing out, I'm sure Clowney is betting that someone's going to get desperate. Someone's going to get desperate. There's going to be my money out there. There's going to be my gold mine eventually. Someone's going to end up paying me. And as the longer we go and the less training camp someone gets in and, the mandates and the protocols, I'm very curious if Jadeveon Clowney is just going to go the route of, if I don't get my money and what I want, I'm not playing for less than $10 million a year.
Well, it might not be the worst year to do that, too.
Yeah, Le'Veon Bell did that. Yeah. He just flat sat it out and said, forget it. Yep. And then what happened? He got paid a huge amount of money by a desperate team the next year.
Yeah, but he needed to become a free
never
agent.
Never again.
Right?
He wasn't never a free got the $14 agent, million right. back, though.
Nope. Saying it was a good decision for him financially overall, but in terms of getting what he wanted, he got what he wanted.
Right.
He sat out an entire year to do it.
Yeah, he just maybe had the wrong idea of what he wanted.
Right.
Okay, storyline number three. Here's a super positive one. Ken Norton and Pete Carroll have to innovate. Period, end of story. And I think it's actually an advantage that nobody is watching them. Remember, Pete Carroll has been very open and on the record. He does not want Hard Knocks. He does not want anybody around. He believes there's a secret sauce in their building with the way they treat people, the way they go about their practice, the way they go about their routine, and all of the resources they pour into their guys. He does not want any part of the outside being on the inside. And while players are accessible and Pete's super accessible, those doors are closed. And behind closed doors, they feel like they've got more juice and more going on that they do not want to share with others. And on the football field, I hope this gives them an opportunity with no cameras out there, with no fans out there, with no bloggers out there, with nobody charting anything out there. They get every opportunity to be more creative and more innovative than they've ever been.
Well, there'll be some of that. I mean, the media is still going to be out there. We're going to be out there. Wyman's going to be out there. Jake's going to be out there. Bumpus going to be out there. We're going to be streaming practice every day at 710sports.com. So Don't make it seem like it's going to be completely away from view. We have some exclusive access there.
We do.
Yes, we do.
But is Hawk Blogger going to be up there charting?
No, but he'll probably be watching the stream at 710sports.com and trying
he
to chart
be.
Off of that.
There you go. Well, that stream is going to be on fire then, because that will be the portal and the access point, whereas largely, Mike, and not just in those practices, I'm talking about their walkthroughs, right? I'm talking about all the stuff they do behind the scenes, even in training camps that we have watched, right? That we've been out there on our picnic bench trying to watch, trying to decipher everything that they're doing. There will be more opportunity to be more clandestine if they indeed want to change up some of that scheme, if they do want to get more innovative. And I think they have to, and they've got more personnel pieces to do it. The Ugo Amadis and the Marquise Blairs and the safeties and the linebacker, everything that we just got done talking about, they've got to be more innovative. It can't just be a Sam strong safety blitz. Okay, are we for the first time going to see a safety in the box next to Bobby Wagner? Is Jamal Adams going to finally break that code and be that kind of difference maker? You certainly invested enough draft capital, and you're going to pay the guy to be, and he loves to be around the line of scrimmage, and he has thrived in those situations before, and he's got instincts for days. So instead of KJ and Bobby being your 2-4-2 nickel linebackers, are you going to finally put that safety down in the box and then free up an Ugo Amadi or a Marquise Blair to, again, carve out a role? And are you going to be more innovative in some of your schemes? So to me, I think they've got to innovate. They've got to create. I think this personnel and this offseason gives them that opportunity.
Well, I appreciate that storyline. I don't know why you refuse to talk about my last one when the answer to my question, how will they change the fact that they don't have a pass rush on paper, is exactly the answer you just gave.
To a degree.
These guys in different new ways.
Yes, but to your point, you still have to have four that beats five. Period.
Fine.
End of story.
But if they don't have four that beats five, what can you do to help? What can you do to alleviate that? Because you have strengths in other places. You got to find a way to, as you just said, use your innovation ability to do it. All right. Storyline three for me is a little more directed. Just the health of the running back room. It's something I'll be watching throughout camp. Yeah. Obviously, Rashad Penny is going to start on the PUP list, so he's not going to be part of it. But they got two guys they love who can't stay healthy. They got another guy who's on, what, his fifth team in 4 years? Carlos Hyde? And then some young dudes that no one really trusts. So for a team that wants to run, right, you can't have this look like the Eddie Lacy years. You've got to find some people that can run the ball. And I know that's out of vogue, and I know the Let Russ Cook people are mad, and I know the people like me who think running backs are largely all the same are going to say this is a waste of time as well. But you got to remember that that's a little distortion and simplification of running backs are all the same. The idea of running backs were all the same is this. There's a couple guys at the very top who make a difference. There's some guys at the bottom who aren't good enough, and all of the guys in the middle are roughly the same. They just have different styles and have to be in the right fit. At least that was my thesis.
Yeah.
If you don't have at least one of the guys in the middle, then you do have a problem with your running game. You have to have somebody who is NFL quality. And, you know, look, Carson's great when he's healthy. Penny's been good, especially last year when he was healthy. Carlos Hyde, I don't know what he is at this stage in his career. And then everyone else after that, first of all, they all seem like carbon copies of each other. They're just like random Miami running backs. So, Brock, if you want to run the ball and be a balanced football team, you better have somebody who can run the ball.
Well, that big old number 32, he's in your upper crust, right?
If he's healthy.
I mean, if you're going to define it that way, as your upper crust, a very large burgeoning middle class, a very similar guys, and then just the lower class you can't win with.
I think that Carson is right on the border of that. I don't know that he is an elite difference maker, completely different from everyone else. Plus, he can't stay healthy. So, no, I can't put him there.
I think his skill set is, but his fumbling and his health, probably knock him down
a
notch.
I mean, like, as a whole, taken as a whole, and I love Chris Carson, and he will have a few plays throughout the year, maybe even, you know, every few games where he just makes your jaw drop. But I would put him in the giant middle class of running backs. He is not so great that he is different from some of the other options out there.
I'd have to put him at the top of that middle class.
All right.
I'd at least have to put him there. I think Carlos Hyde is in that middle class. He was a 1,000-yard rusher. Yeah, I don't think he's Eddie Lacy. I don't think he's at the bottom tier. I don't think he's that year they ran through 9 different guys in 8 weeks. I think Carlos Hyde is a pretty legitimate dude and on a good team with a good scheme and an amazing quarterback. I think he's going to have an opportunity to be that number two. I think Rashad Penny, they're going to be unbelievably careful with. And he will be itching and climbing to get back. And then Homer and Dallas are going to fight to make the team on special teams. So, yes, I would agree that that room for this team and this organization is critical. And if you want to look at the splits, look at life when Russell Wilson's had Chris Carson and when he hasn't the last two Decembers. Sure. And you've seen the entire thing fall on his shoulders. Chris is a big, big part of it and motivated and I hope healthy. I think a positive sign, unlike Lano Hill, remember when he came off his hip injury that offseason and we watched him out there miss every mini camp and then he was slow to start training camp. Well, Chris Carson was not slow to start training camp. He was not on the pup. He's ready to go. And as I said earlier, I think highly motivated.
What do you think they do last year if Carson and Penny don't get hurt? How different do you think the end of the year? You think maybe they beat the Niners in the last game?
I think they beat the
season?
Niners.
You think then all of a sudden they have a first-round bye and they end up...
I don't know if they have that first round. They would have had to beat the Niners and beat the Cardinals, right?
Yeah.
And that Cardinals game was without Duane Brown and they tried to flip people over on the line and DeMarco...
Maybe, but if you were coming off of the Niners game, how different would that Cardinals game have been? If you had been coming off a win... Right? Cardinals game came after the Niners game,
did
right?
it come after?
I don't think so.
Dude,
I'm just trying to ask the questions here. Why you got to start throwing facts at us? I guess my point is, if those two guys have been healthy, maybe do they do things a little bit differently? Do they at least get to the NFC Championship game?
Correct.
I don't know. It's at least a worthy question. But
those two are healthy. December is different last year, I believe.
Or if Will Disley is healthy, does he make that catch and plow over the goal line where Jacob Hollister was 1 millimeter short?
But Jacob Hollister is not big.
I wasn't trying to be mean to you, by the way. I was trying to think myself.
It felt
what
mean.
What order Brock, was that?
If it you responded like... with crickets.
Right, it felt mean. Just saying so.
You left him on an island.
That's right.
Okay, we're down to our final four, my final two storylines. And I think Brady Henderson wrote about this. Jay Keeps talked about it. And that is, can this defense get its swagger back?
I think I got my swagger back.
Whether it's being innovative, whether it's more pass rush, whether it's Quentin Dunbar covering people, whether it's all the X's and O's and all that good stuff, but ultimately, can Jamal Adams be that force? Something we talked about last week with his personality and his demeanor and how much and how loud he likes to be, and he is willing to talk and be out front. You know, it's something that defense in its heyday for year after year after year after year was. They were loud, they were proud, they were out front, they were dominant. And you did not come into CenturyLink Field and ever feel comfortable in the last 2 years. And speaking of that Cardinals game the end of last year, Kenyon Drake running through you, running over you, running around you. Brett Hundley coming into the game. Remember when backup quarterbacks came into the game in CenturyLink Field and literally cowered?
Terrible.
They melted on their drop back. They didn't even want to stand in the pocket. Brett Hundley was out there just cocksure of himself, like, yep, I got this. And he's running over people and running for
Coy
first
Detmer
downs.
Detmer ended up outrunning, what's his name, with the fork sticking out of his back last year.
Ziggy Ansah.
Was it Coy Detmer?
Well, no, it was Ty Detmer, I believe.
It wasn't Coy?
Oh, no. Wait.
It was Josh McCown.
Oh, sorry. I thought it was Coy
Luke
Detmer.
McCown? No.
It wasn't Coy Detmer who
Cade
did that?
Cade McNown.
Can I ask you a question about Jamal Adams? So I think this is a good conversation in here about whether or not they can get their swagger. I'm with you. And Jamal Adams is certainly the guy who's most likely to deliver on, and I think that's why, you know, a bigger part of the reason they made the trade. He had a tweet this week. Now, do you see this? It's the picture of him in a studio. I think he's getting ready for some sort of like Madden filming or something like that. And the line he wrote was, 1,000 burpees on the path to my own destruction or success.
Oh, my own destruction.
What does that mean? Is that 1,000 burpees at a time? That can't be right?
No, can't do
he
it.
Can't do 1,000 burpees
nope.
in a sitting, right?
Nope.
It's you'd require possible. Resuscitation.
Yeah. So, but 1,000 burpees, like, in his lifetime or in the off-season.
In a
season,
day. Maybe in a day.
In a day?
Yeah. Still
in
a day.
That doesn't seem
right. It's insane.
Right.
But
no,
oh,
because
for sure.
Well, you're just sweating all day?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No way.
Yeah, that's right.
So, like, you're telling me, okay, I did my 100 burpees. Now I'm going to go take a shower because I'm done working out. Now I'm going to do another 100 burpees?
10 sets
oh,
of 100.
Easily.
No way.
Oh, yeah.
Easily.
Absolutely.
No. So then you got to go take another
absolutely.
Shower?
No, you're not taking showers.
So hold on, you're telling me then that Jamal Adams does 100 burpees and doesn't sweat?
No,
you don't
he
think he could do 1,000 burpees in an hour?
So you're saying he smells?
In an hour?
You want to say that to his face?
Yeah, absolutely.
That he smells?
You say, this is the price. I'm the price I pay. I'm paying
maybe
this
that's
price.
What he meant by his own destruction.
Mr. Why President, you stink.
1,000 burpees over the course of the summer doesn't seem like enough, but in a day or in a sitting seems like
I mean,
too many.
A week?
1,000 burpees a week.
Yeah, that's reasonable.
Why don't you tweet him and say
150 a day?
This is going to dominate our podcast this week.
Just need to clarify, Prez. Correct.
How many burpees in a sitting?
He may do 1,000 in a sitting.
Come on. You think that's possible? 1,000 burpees at a time?
Yes.
You don't do a burpee in a sitting either.
I watched Joe Davis do this routine of squat, shoulder press, burpee, push-up jumps. So more than just a burpee. And he did 100 in 20 minutes. 100 of each of those. Push-ups, burpees, squat jumps, shoulder press.
That's 400.
But the burpee itself is just, it's debilitating.
It is. For your body and my body and Howdy's body and Kyle's body. But when you're in that kind of shape, I bet you he can do, I'd be willing to bet he could do 1,000 burpees in one sitting. I don't know if that's an hour.
There's breaks in between.
For sure. Okay. For sure.
How many burpees do you think he could do without a break? Like in a row?
How many do you think you could do?
I could do like 20.
This sounds like a good charity.
It's so
event.
Hard.
I probably
burpees
do four.
Are exhausting.
Like four or five, maybe.
And then I just start like.
Do you think this could be a good charity event?
No, I don't think so.
Mm-mm. I think it could be. Like we get people to donate. Like you do 1,000 burpees in a day.
In a day?
Sure.
There's no way.
You donate $1,000 for Salk's 1,000 burpees? I'd do it. To one of your causes.
I could not do 1,000 burpees in a day.
I couldn't do it.
No way.
For one of your causes?
Nope. How many do you think he could do in a row?
That's a good question.
100?
By the way, would he be your choice? If you could pick any Seahawk to do as many burpees in a row in one sitting, would El Prez be your pick?
Maybe he's big, though. I mean, like, he's got to, like, there's a lot of weight.
Correct.
He's got to pull up.
He's a little guy.
That's why I wouldn't go Carson, even though he's strictly
You wouldn't
jacked.
Go DK Metcalf.
Like an Ugo Amadi type?
You'd go like Ugo Amadi.
Trey Flowers.
No, you know who.
No, Trey Flowers is too tall. Like, Ugo Amadi would be on my
somebody
list.
Somebody crazy. Like a totally crazy
John Ursua.
Ben Burkervin.
Could be.
No, it wouldn't be Ben Burkervin.
Definitely not Ben Burkervin.
No, that's not who I'd choose.
Ben Burkervin is not the one who's doing
it. No, that's not who I go with.
Cody Barton.
No. Cody Barton.
In fact, Cody Barton, that suit that he was wearing for his picture, it fit him before he did the 1,000 burpees.
All right. Well, my fourth storyline is this one, Brock. Talking weaponry. Do they have enough weapons for us? He wanted stars. He got one on defense in Jamal Adams. He got a bunch of random offensive linemen detritus and an older tight end. So he said he wants Gordon. He said he wants Antonio Brown, etc. So is there enough weaponry for Russell Wilson to do what he wants to do? He's got Lockett. He's got Metcalf. I'll admit I'm still nervous about DK Metcalf. Not about his ability. Obviously, he's shown he's got it, but about his ability to stay healthy, about his availability. Can he be healthy as much as he was last year throughout a second season? I'm going to continue to worry about it. There's very little anyone could say to convince me otherwise. So do they have enough weaponry to satisfy Russell Wilson?
I would say yes. My answer to that is yes, because Russell has always taken whatever is around him and made it better. So yes, but I would say it is tremendously thin, especially to win your division. And this is all about winning your division. It's about winning the NFC West. And to do so, and if you do so, you'll be one of the best teams in this league because it's the most brutal division. But you just mentioned DK. Like, if DK pulls a hamstring and is out for 6 weeks, if Lockett gets hurt again, if Greg Olsen at this stage of his career who's banged up, if Will Disley who's come off two injury-shortened seasons, like, on paper right now, he's got enough. You got enough. But you start to lose guys, I get real worried because Philip Dorsett couldn't make it work with Luck and Brady. And John Ursua, for some reason, it's kind of like the whole rest of that redshirt freshman class kind of got redshirted for whatever reason. And I like him. I think he's got some game, but he too is a guy that was banged up an awful lot in college. And we'll see. And to count on somebody that's never done it before, it gets very, very thin very quickly.
All right, why don't you give me your number one of ones here, buddy?
Is your number one of ones include Russell Wilson, too?
No.
It doesn't.
Well, I told you mine weren't in order.
Okay.
So it's just more like his one of five.
Yeah, my one of ones is Russell Wilson was ranked the second best player by his peers in this league for his play in 2019. If they're going to win their division, he's got to be that same kind of player in 2020. He's got to play exquisite ball, not slow down a lick, continue to be the incredible player that he has been, durable, reliable, tough as nails.
That's weak.
Russell's got to play at that level if they're going to win the NFC West.
No, duh. That one doesn't count. Of course, Russell has to play well. That's a storyline you're watching. Can Russell play well?
No kidding. Offseason?
Dude, it's Russell Wilson, and he's with a band of merry men. Like, of course he's got to play well.
Russell Wilson loves routine. Mm-hmm. He loves it. I've watched it.
Right.
His guru can tell you about it, man. He loves it. He loves having April and May and June and July and taking guys to work out and train with him.
If the one thing you're watching is whether or not Russell Wilson can have a good year this year, then good luck.
I am watching to see that Russell Wilson plays to the level that he played at in 2019. Because 2019 was different than 18 and 17 and 16 and 15. It was. He took another step up.
I don't agree with that, by the way. It's basically the same. It's just that a few other people finally noticed it.
That's fine. You don't have to agree with that.
Good.
That's my storyline, and I'm sticking to it.
All right, Mom.
Okay. You're number one?
It's not my one. It's just my last one. Maybe it's number five.
One of five.
I'm not giving you any numbers attached to this one.
We keep going if you want.
I guess it is along those same lines of just how well they're situated to handle the lack of practice in pregame or preseason. Like, do you need to have more consistency in your roster in order to handle this? The Niners went to the Super Bowl last year. The Rams are largely intact. I mean, like, the Cardinals are kind of on the come. Are they actually well situated to handling this? They've got a coach who's obviously tenured and a quarterback who's tenured. So, and in many ways, their offense has a lot of that consistency, but their defense is so many different pieces. I wonder how well they can bring all of them together without a regular training camp, without preseason, and then kind of jumping into this strange year. That's got me a little jittery.
No, I think that's fair. And I have said on the college football front, as people last week when the schedules came out, we actually started to talk about football a little bit. And if this happens, I said, oh, man. Oregon is going to have an enormous advantage. They bring back 10 starters on defense, and any program that has established studs is going to be at a even bigger advantage than they've been in years past and before, with no spring and no summer and a shortened training camp and no hitting. San Francisco brings back 10 starters on defense. The one that didn't return, they traded away and ended up taking a top 15 pick in the draft, and Kinlaw that they think can come in and be on that D line and be a force. So they return everybody. They return their system offensively, mm-hmm. and most of their pieces. And Arizona returns most of their pieces and added more youth than speed. And McVay and Goff and Aaron Donald are still in LA. And, you know, yes, you return Tyler and Russ and Shoddy and Carson, but you could have 80% new people on your offensive line. On top of that defense that, as we said, is going to have new faces and does need to innovate, and on paper on that D-line is a bit treacherous. So, yeah, I think that's a very fair point, and I bet it's one that's kept Pete up at night, because Pete Carroll also, like his quarterback, is a creature of routine and habit and knows the importance of language and knows the importance of getting everybody on the same page and how critical it was for him for a decade here to use April and May and June and July to inundate his guys with their program. And now you're going to have to do it in warp speed with, you know, a bunch of new faces.
Yeah. Good stuff. There's our top five storylines apiece. Just because of the way the podcast works, et cetera. This year we will not have our most intriguing Seahawks countdown. But if we were to,
that would have started 25 weeks ago. This week, number 25.
Seahawks hadn't finished last year yet, but we'd be doing that. Yeah, we don't have time to do it that way. But I was trying to think about who would be on my top three to top five list there.
Ooh.
Of most intriguing Seahawks heading into this year. And I think the three, I'm trying to hear my, off the top of my head, the five names that would be, not necessarily in order. I haven't figured that out yet.
Yeah, you're not big order guy.
Not right now. No, I'd have to take some time to put them in order.
Don't distort his order.
Okay. Today's not a big day for order.
I'm not into order.
There's been a lot of distortion with that.
It'd be Collier, Adams, Blair.
Are you crazy? You're forgetting one bigger than I think a bunch of those. You crazy?
In terms of most intriguing heading into this year?
Yes.
I mean, Collier, Adams, and Blair are all going to be at the top of my list. Brooks will probably be maybe just outside the top. Who am I missing that's so intriguing?
Dunbar.
Oh, Dunbar. I don't know. Is he going to play?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, he's just going to remove the exempt list. He's going to play.
But that doesn't, he can still get suspended.
He can.
You don't think he will?
Something has to happen first.
He'll get suspended.
Consensus seems to be that he may not, that not getting suspended is kind of most likely right now because he did not have a gun.
Okay.
He was not holding.
He was still there at the whole thing. Like, I don't know.
I agree.
Would guess
I agree.
Be
but Clayton was saying yesterday, like, no, I don't think he'll be suspended. Heaps doesn't.
He
think
could
he'll
be just for hiring his lawyer.
Yeah, Rico.
How does he not get suspended? That's crazy. He should be suspended. What are we talking about?
I mean, if you were present at an armed robbery,
he should be suspended. Maybe not for 8 games or anything crazy. He should be suspended at least 2 games.
His argument would be, I was at a poker game. DeAndre Baker pulled a gun. No. I didn't know he was going to do that. I'm like, what, guilty by association?
Yeah, well, that's sort of how the suspension list works. You put yourself in a bad situation with the wrong people at the wrong time. You may very well get suspended, yes. Based on the previous history and the precedent, he should be suspended at least for a game or two.
I don't think he'll be suspended. I don't know. I'm kind of with Clayton. I don't think he'll be suspended.
So he's in. Okay, all right. You think he's above those guys?
I think
he's more intriguing than Jamal Adams?
He's a starting cornerback.
I wouldn't put him above Jamal.
Above Marquise Blair, maybe. Blair's intriguing. How will he be deployed?
He's not in my top 10. He may not play this year. He may not even play.
What are you talking about?
I don't even think he's going to play. They got a whole secondary in front of him. I don't think he's even going to play. They're going to reverse LJ Collier.
That will definitely
right
be intriguing.
Not play him at all.
That will be intriguing if he doesn't play, for sure. That will be very intriguing.
Greg Olson intrigue you?
No. Yeah. Not really.
No.
Not even a little.
BJ Finney?
Who?
Brandon Schell?
I don't know who those people are. You're making up names now. They're not particularly intriguing.
DK Metcalf's got to be up there, given the surprise he was in year one.
Yeah, he'd be in the top 10, for
Quinn
sure.
Quinn Dunbar would be my top 3. He can take the ball away. He's had 9 career interceptions. Shaquille Griffin's got 3. Jamal Adams got 2. So he's a guy that can take the ball away. You traded for him.
Oh.
You believed in Trey Flowers enough for a couple years to give him opportunity, but you know you need a difference maker in this secondary to play the kind of defense you want to play. He'd be way up on my list for sure.
I'll tell you who might be in my top 5, and you guys may laugh at this one, is Bobby Wagner.
Mm.
What kind of year is Bobby going to have? By all accounts, he had a good year last year, but if you watched every game, it wasn't the same Bobby.
Yep.
So are we going to get the guy that they spent an unbelievable amount of money on? If so, that's a huge win for this defense, and if he gets the help around him to do it, that's a big win for them.
Where's Cedric Oboye with the jumbo tight end?
I thought isn't he the guy that opted
Chance
out?
Warmack.
Chance Warmack. Oh,
Chase Womack.
You're
right.
Getting your burnout former first-round picks.
Okay, yeah, we're about done with your name.
We're going to add Marcel Darius let's
move
confuse
on.
You on that.
All right. I'll tell you what, man. This is the time. Have you done – I know, Brock, you were always talking about your love language thing. And so
it's called The 5 Love Languages, Gary Chapman's great book. Yeah.
As I said, you're always talking about your love language thing. And I think date night and time spent, isn't that one of them?
Oh, yeah. Quality time.
Quality time. There you go. That's one of the love languages. Well, it's obviously been tricky here over the last few months to get the right kind of quality time just based on the pandemic and a lot of things have been closed, et cetera. So our friends at Ascend have a really cool deal for you, Brock, and it's a really great way to do an at-home date night. So every Friday throughout this month here in August, Ascend is teaming up with Upchurch Vineyards, and they have an exclusive Ascend at Home 3-course Taste of Summer dinner package. They're perfectly paired with a bottle of Upchurch Vineyard wine. It's an incredible value once you go through the whole thing, and you get your whole, you know, quality time spent with an at-home date night and great food. So this week, the main course is an American Wagyu filet. Then they're doing King Salmon. There's a barbecue prime short rib. So a 3-course meal, and each week it is something different for your Friday night. All right, that's what they're doing for at home. Just watch the Ascend Prime Instagram for giveaways all month long. This week, they're giving away a Taste of Summer dinner for 2 and a wine tasting and charcuterie experience for 5 at the Upchurch Red Mountain Winery. So a lot of cool stuff going on. Go to ascendprime.com or follow them on Instagram in order to see all of that they have going on. You can see their menu items, promotions, with their location, or just go to Bellevue yourself. Check out Ascend in person. How good are the views at Ascend?
Yeah.
How good?
Ridiculous.
Scale of 1 to 10, how
10.
Good are the views?
10.
I might say 11. I feel like you're underselling
goes
it at 10.
To 11.
It's not fair to just cut it off at 10. All right. Go to ascendprime.com. All right, Brock, we gotta get a little bit more to the bottom of not just what's going on in the college football world, but where it's going to end up. And I don't mean the news, as we talk here to Bruce Feldman from Fox Sports, longtime friend of this show. Bruce, we're not going to get into the news because, as you know, people listen to these podcasts at all different times. So by the time they listen to this, the Pac-12 may have canceled their season. Who knows what happens with the Big Ten? The SEC may be the only conference left on Earth by the time this is done. So taking the news out of this and just kind of talking generally about what's happening and where it's going, I think the question that I've had most is trying to understand the relationship between these two gigantic simultaneous stories. On one hand, COVID-19, the pandemic, you know, shutting down because of health reasons and the players trying to stand up for their own health concerns. And at the other side of it, working at the same time, this sort of unionization, rights for college players, We Are United, potential strike by the players. What is the relationship between these two stories?
Yeah, I think in some ways it's either the worst possible time for something like this because it's happening in the middle of a global pandemic, or maybe it's the ideal time. You know, it's everything is so crazy right now, and all these stories are moving so fast. I did a story on The Athletic that went up Monday night, and it was about a Wazoo defensive lineman, Dallas Hodge. He's a good player, but it's not like he's Trevor Lawrence or Justin Fields or Penei Sewell or somebody like that, who is an All-American candidate. But he found himself on this call late Sunday night because the two movements seem to be merging or seem to be lining up. And Hobbs is really great talent. Why he was on there is because he's a gifted graphic designer, and he was going to scramble and turn something around in 30 minutes to get it up. And I think this kind of shows you a little bit of a window into not how much of a fly-by-seat-of-the-pants thing is going on, but so much stuff is getting reacted to on social media, and it's almost feels like it's impossible to keep up with all this stuff.
What would you say, Bruce, and you've covered college sports for a long time, what would you say you have learned in particular over these last months of the pandemic, or maybe even in the last couple weeks as football has tried to get going? Is there something new that you've learned?
Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff, I think, Brock. Some of what I would say is that as everybody kind of processes what is happening, you know, I think, like, Scott Satterfield made a great, compelling point, I thought, Monday. And we saw coaches moving about this. And I think one thing that really resonated with me, and I'm not saying this would be a reason to say, hey, whatever the medical experts said, we're going to factor that in, but that's not going to be the be-all, end-all. But what he said was essentially that, you know what, our players have done everything we have asked them to do, everything. And when everything normally we think of with college football is do the workouts, do the training, take care of your diet, those things, don't, you know, protect the team, you know, is an expression you probably would have heard from Pete Carroll's guys or whatever, meaning don't do anything stupid going out at night or anything to embarrass yourself or the program. But in the context of this, and I did a story over the weekend about Kent State football team and Sean Lewis, their young coach there, and the story was pretty powerful, I thought, because they had found out in the middle of their practice that their season was canceled or postponed till the spring. And one of the players stood up and said, "Coach, the bad news can wait. Can we have 50 finish this off? We got special teams. Give us 15 minutes." And the coach said, "Yeah, let's roll." And it's all about these guys love being with each other and playing with each other and practicing. And they've been taking the message of finish, which I'm sure Brock has probably heard from the time, you know, he was a little guy, from his dad and probably from everybody else around him. And I think that's a message that goes beyond football or beyond basketball or beyond whatever sport you love. But I thought what Scott Satterfield articulated and something that Sean Lewis had told me is we have asked these guys to be so responsible in terms of, it's not just about, hey, don't go to a party, don't go to the bars tonight. It's like, don't go to like your friend's apartment just because you guys are going to get together and play Madden. Just don't do it. So I'm not saying they're asking them to live like monastic lifestyles, but they have asked that all of a sudden. And now you're going to say, hey, you've done everything we've asked you to do. And we'll look at the numbers of what we have. We know what internally, at least in this program, what we our testing numbers are. And sorry, you're not going to play. And I'm not saying that that's the decision made for Louisville or that's the decision made for the ACC, but that is kind of one of the things that I think maybe doesn't get told enough in our space is not just that these guys care about what they do, but I think that that by and large, an overwhelming number, really care about who they're around, who their teammates are, what it represents, more so than probably, you know, it's easy to be cynical and say, okay, these guys want X, Y, and Z, or they're posting all, you know, some self-absorbed stuff on social media, whatever. Because I think a lot of times the small amount of that is the thing that everybody holds up and you know, becomes a viral clip around Twitter. And I think this has been a good reminder of what's at the core of college sports.
Yeah, that makes sense. And beyond all of that, I'm sure there's a frustration level of, hey, you asked me to essentially isolate and not go to parties and not play Madden and just be with my team, and I did all of those things, and now you still want to cancel the season even after that? I'm sure there's an immense amount of frustration on the part of the players. I mean, that'd be true of anybody, and certainly of college kids. I mean, I remember being in college when some friends had trips abroad, you know, study abroad trips canceled because of some not full scale war, but of international incidents that can't, and they were devastated by it, and they were upset. And I'm sure if they had had social media at the time in the 90s, they would have taken to social media to protest and say, "I want to go on my trip." But who ultimately needs to kind of make these decisions?
I mean, ultimately, they are got to lean on the medical experts, right? I mean, look, if it came down to it, I'm sure there was a lot of players who would say, you know what, it's good. My head's fine. I'm going to stay on the field. Whether it came to concussion protocol or things of that nature, you know, ultimately, there are experts for this. It's not going to be a football coach's decision, right? And I think one of the challenges here, and none of us are lawyers, I don't think, is what happens when it comes to the liability issues and that hangover the sport. And that potentially down the road, it could be a real problem.
Where do you see college football going, Bruce? Because I'm of the firm opinion that this is just going to continue to expedite the shifting sands that college football finds itself on, the immense difference between the haves and the have-nots. You know, Mike and I, for a decade on a radio show, have talked a ton about college athletics and where it's going. And I'm of the belief that it's going to shrink, that there's going to be super conferences, that there's going to be those that the landscape looks entirely different from what you and I experience and have experienced over the decades working in it and watching it growing up. Where do you fall on that spectrum?
I absolutely think, it's going in that direction. I did a story late last week talking to Jeff Choate. You guys know him. He was on Coach Pete's staff at Boise and Washington, and he was brutally honest with the haves and the have-nots and being squeezed out and doing all the right things and still being. He was. I don't want to use this from him, but I've heard a lot of other coaches who've said this, disgusted. He was frustrated. He was angry and all those things and he was sad because he sees where it's going. And I think this has ramped it up and sped it up even further.
So where does this all end? Right. I mean, whether the seasons are canceled or not, I mean, how could college football look different here in another year or so with realignment, with rules changes, with, I mean, how do you think all of this finally sorts itself out?
I don't know. I don't know because I think right now so many things are happening so fast. It's hard to say. I mean, we're in a pandemic. I don't know how, you know, crippling the implications of all this are going to be. I mean, you know, I'd love to say, hey, they're going to delay the season and start maybe in mid-October and go into January. But who knows what, you know, it's just hard to say. I think anybody who tells you they have real answers for this is kidding you or they're kidding themselves. I really don't think anybody knows that stuff.
Which do you think is the bigger issue? Is it the pandemic and its effect on college sports, or is it the, you know, I'll say unionization for lack of a better term, but which is the bigger story?
I think it's the pandemic because it's health issues, to be honest. I mean, the unionization thing has floated around for a while now. Name, image, and likeness is coming around, but I think it's the pandemic because if you're talking about, we don't know the health issues of this. If what the Big Ten medical experts and some of the Pac-12 medical experts have talked about, you know, it's just so much uncertainty with that, right? I think it goes beyond. It's just when you're talking about also potential liability and massive litigation on top of that, I think that would factor into everything else. I mean, but it's all kind of connected here. It's just, I mean, the pandemic is so much bigger though than college football. That's the thing here. Whereas unionization is a college football story. I mean, it's probably more than that because it gets political too, but I think there's just so many pieces here.
I wonder whether it ends up with someone who's more in charge of what's going on. And Brock and I have talked about this for a long time, sort of the idea of a commissioner of the NCAA, somebody who does the scheduling, somebody who could actually be in charge. It feels like one of the problems you run into now is that there's nobody truly in charge with any amount of power. And it's not like I'm a huge Roger Goodell fan necessarily or any of the other commissioners in sports, but at least you've got one person who's capable of making decisions, of negotiating, of doing what's in the best interest of everybody, even if some people end up getting, you know, not everyone ends up winning in every scenario, the league wins. It feels like college football and college sports in general are really missing that right now.
You don't think Mark Emmert's plan of just letting the schools make all the decisions?
Is he still in power? I haven't heard a word from Mark Emmert in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, exactly. You know, to be honest here, just like our buddy Tim Brando has chirped about a czar for college football for years, and while that may be good in theory, do you think Greg Sankey and the SEC are going to want to be told what they need to do by somebody who's connected to the Mountain West or somebody who's connected to the Pac-12? It doesn't line up like that. They're not going to do it. I'm not sure Kevin Warren, like, these guys are so out for themselves and their investors. Just the Pac-12, I mean, has, and a lot of people in the Big Ten and other country conferences have wanted the SEC to at least have some of the same scheduling protocols when it comes to the college football playoff. And the SEC has said, no, we're not doing that because we don't have to do that. So again, I mean, it's a great idea in theory. Call me skeptical that the SEC is going to go for it, or that the Big Ten is going to be told what's in the best interest of the game as opposed to what's in the best interest of their bottom line. We've just seen too much of this from too many turns.
Well, I nominate Tim Brando to be the czar of college football.
Brock, I wouldn't even nominate Tim Brando to be the czar of the foursome he's in right now.
Thank you, Brucey. So much appreciate the time. I know you're a busy man, and thanks for filling in some of the blanks.
My pleasure.
There's Bruce Feldman, friend of the show, of course, from Fox Sports. First of all, the Tim Brando thing, but I can't let one of those last things he said go, which is that the commissioners will just do what's good for their bottom line. And I think a lot of that is at the crux of the conversation and debate that you and I have had for a decade.
Yep.
And that's my fear. Look, I was asked this on Tom, Jake, and Stacey earlier this week, which was, you know, it was about paying the kids and the kids actually getting a fair share. And as I've tried to say a bunch of times, the issue isn't necessarily with the kids getting the money. The issue is with everybody else getting the money, if that makes sense. It's not like I think college kids need to get rich or I think college kids deserve a certain amount of money or anything like that. It's that the college football system was set up, you know, for without television rights, without billions of dollars poured in. And once that enormous amount of money arrives, it's about how to fairly divide it. It's not like I think the kids deserve a huge amount of money. It's that I think everyone else around them is getting a lot of money because they do care only about their bottom line and not about anything else. And because of that, that's the problem I've always had with the inequity there.
Yeah, well, I think there's obviously a lot there. We will never settle this debate, which is a great thing. That's why this podcast is going to go till 2055, because I you know, this is one of those topics that is going to be very, very difficult to ever try to grasp and understand. I found a point Jeff Schwartz made last week. I've reiterated it a number of times on different programs, and I think it's a good one, and that is the player name, image, and likeness is going to be the first step into these players getting a cut of the action that I have said they've deserved. That, you know what, 25 years ago when my jersey was sold, that number 7, I took great pride in it. I thought it was really amazing. That was awesome. I didn't necessarily think I deserved a cut, but the money in college football was not what the money has become right in this day and age.
And again, hold on, let me just jump in. It's not about you deserving a cut. It's about everybody else making a lot of money off of it.
And everybody else in this case, as Bruce referenced, are these conferences, right, that are going to the Big Ten and the SEC and these conferences that have amazing TV deals, because not everybody is making huge money in the Pac-12. I mean, Larry Scott is. I think Larry Scott's going to be out of his job after all of this is said and done eventually.
No, he's not. Larry Scott survives every year. Larry Scott, if he has long gone.
I mean, arguably, this is the most guts Larry Scott has ever shown. What are you talking about?
He's just always alive.
Not going to lose his job over this. There's no way.
He might double his salary.
Seriously.
Let me actually put him in charge of academics, too.
Well, maybe not. Maybe not a great point. Right
no
there.
Way. The Brock, I think that again, you're sort of helping with my point. The idea that the goobers who run the Big Ten and the Big 12 and the SEC and the ACC, the idea that those guys are going to be the ones getting rich is specifically why the whole thing offends me.
Okay, but they are going
Bishop
to
Sankey and the SEC. Whatever. What's the guy's name?
Greg Sankey.
That guy get Greg
Did
Sankey.
Did you say Bishop Sankey?
Yeah, I was joking. Greg Sankey getting rich. That guy getting rich off of is like the whole reason why. And Mike's live before him. Oh, you didn't think I knew that, did you? Oh.
Jim Delaney.
Oh.
That's a guy from the Big Ten.
Yeah.
Yeah, dude, I know those names.
Mike, you're up.
You know why? Because they're a bunch of goobers who made a gazillion dollars off the backs of unpaid labor.
Well, they've largely made it because of the TV right deals that and the exposure that those TV deals have created.
Sure, but you think the TV stations and networks want to pay a whole bunch of money to watch Mike's live, Bishop Sankey,
nope,
and Jim Delaney talk?
Nope.
Nobody wants to pay to see that. They got rich because incredible athletes did remarkable things on the field, and a lot of people wanted to watch them.
Yes.
And because of it, they found the best ways to funnel the money to themselves. That's gross.
There's an aspect of that I cannot disagree with, that in many of these conferences and in the commissioners and the people in these offices that make a whole bunch of money that is directly tied to the television revenue. I don't know, 20 some years ago, if the commissioner of the Pac-12 made the kind of income on scale, right, that the guys and gals today make. I'm gonna say no.
Before all these big TV deals, how could they?
Correct.
There wasn't enough money in it
because that revenue did not come in.
Right.
But now that revenue has come in, and it's created for the SEC and the Big Ten in particular, who've had huge success with their networks. It's created a belief that, yeah, you know, we're not going to be told by anybody else what to do. I'm sorry, Pac-12. No, we're not going to have a czar over the conferences because, you know, we bring how much gold to the platter here versus what is your conference doing? What is your network doing? The Olympic Channel rates higher than the Pac-12 network does. Oh,
no,
you're not bringing
NBC Olympics.
What is that?
It's an NBC like SN type of a.
They're playing. Yeah. Seriously, they're playing opening and closing vaulting ceremonies like all day.
Really?
Oh yeah.
From back in the day,
but it's like the 2008 200 meter men's freestyle.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, all right.
Oh, that's terrible. But more interesting than the Pac-12.
The Big Ten and SEC are bringing a ton of money. WSU's athletic department's in the red.
Right.
UW was operating under a deficit, 2 years ago?
Yes.
So it's not nationwide across the whole landscape.
Nope, it's the Big Ten and the SEC, and we'll see about the ACC network as it gets going. I'm gonna imagine that it, because of Clemson and some of the following, Florida State and such, they will, and you know, their exposure and their numbers will do pretty well. But you know, the Longhorn Network did not. That thing went belly up. The Pac-12 Network is on the verge of, I think, going belly up. And the SEC and the Big Ten is seeing massive riches because of the success of Ohio State and Michigan and the people that want to follow it and the people that want to watch it, the people that want to give to those programs, right? And the people that are so passionate about it That is what you have in those conferences. Wow. And as Bruce said, to think that you could have a central force, you know, rule over that and say, yeah, yeah, this is, we're going to do it for the betterment of all. It's going to be a tremendous, tremendous challenge.
I think there's an interesting thing in there. And I know I always take my pot shots at the Pac-12. So I'll lay off for a moment and try to help explain why. If you were, you could make an argument that based on record in bowl games, although, you know, I discount that by quite a bit, but even just where people are drafted, et cetera, that all five conferences have similar value. Not the same. The SEC and the Big Ten are probably at the highest point of that, but that the five power conferences are all worthy of being mentioned in the same breath as each other, right? Talent wise. You see guys go in the first round from all of the conferences, et cetera. I mean, like, their talent is somewhat spread throughout the entirety of college football. Yeah, all right, they get a few more big defensive linemen in the SEC, et cetera, and some. But overall, I think you can make that case. I think what happened, though, is because of that, as the SEC and the Big Ten started to get bigger, everyone in the surrounding conferences said, oh, there's a ton of money here. Just look. People, and they took it to mean the country, is incredibly interested and passionate about college football to the point where they're willing to pay an enormous amount of money for it, and the eyeballs are going to be on TV, and the desperation is there. We're all going to find a way now to take advantage of that, led by, and because, hey, if the SEC's doing it, why aren't you doing it?
Yeah, we all got 40,000 people in all these stadiums every
week. That's right. If the Big 12 is doing it, why don't you do it, right? Oh, absolutely. Okay, well, I want to jump in, and I want to be a part of it, or else I'm a bad commissioner, and I'm a bad league, and we can't possibly keep up. And Brock, I've heard you say these things, right? We talked about it however many years ago. If the Pac-12 doesn't find a way to do some of the same things as the SEC, they're going to get left in the dust, and they're not going to get all the same talent, and then the disparity really would be real. But the problem is, and I say this with love and truth, Pac-12 fans, you don't care as much.
No, you don't.
Not even close.
Not even.
So every time you want to get mad at me for making fun of the Pac-12 for being a tree falling in the forest this week, oh, the Pac-12 is going to cancel its games. You think anyone's going to notice? No, not the Pac-12 fans and not anybody around the country, because you don't care that much. You care. And of course, there's individuals of you out there. And if you're shouting at your whatever it is you listen to a podcast on right now, whatever headphone is. Like, I get it. You're mad. You're mad that I said that. But I'm not mad at you. I'm not saying you're the problem. There aren't enough of you.
Yes.
You are unique. You love the Pac-12 and think that Oregon and Washington and Washington State
I spend
State
my
USC,
disposable income. I use my vacation
yes,
days.
You
I
do.
Use all of my resources to follow Pac-12.
And you're the only person I know like
not.
That.
It's a very sad existence.
Yes.
Is it Washington State football?
Yes.
Really? Yes.
You are spending your life following and obsessed with something that not enough people care about to that extent. Guess what? If you lived in Alabama, every person you knew would be doing that. Everyone.
Not everyone.
Now, half of them would be going to Auburn games instead of Alabama games. Don't get me wrong.
That's right.
But every person you, because they have everything else.
It's different.
There is no other team sport. There's no NFL team there.
Sport.
There's no pro sport. They're, quite frankly, there's nothing to do.
It's not concerts. There's not.
You are going to your Alabama game every Saturday, and you're making plans around it, as is everyone else. I've told the story how many times of my buddy who went to the wedding in Arkansas,
dressed
the day where they
elephant.
Screwed it up as the Arkansas, it happened to be the Arkansas LSU game. That was the like crazy back and forth game with what's the kid's name, Hester and
Jacob Hester.
Yes, and the run Darren McFadden and all those guys were in that crazy back and forth game. And this poor girl, they had the wedding, and then everyone sat in the corner watching the game while she and like two of her friends danced on the dance floor. Then they lost, and everyone went home miserable from her wedding.
Well, yeah.
You think that would happen here? Oh, no. I accidentally scheduled my wedding on a day where Washington State was playing Oregon State. Oh, no. Like, nothing would happen. And so because of it, asking the Pac-12 to keep up with all these other conferences and bring in so much money, there's no chance.
Right.
They don't have a prayer. And it's not Larry, as much as I don't like Larry Scott, it's not his fault. It's not the coach's fault. It's not the school's fault. It's your fault.
Yeah.
You don't care enough as a group of fans. And if there's some one thing that is Larry Scott's fault, it's betting that you did. It's assuming that people on the West Coast cared as much about football as the people in the Southeast. And they just don't.
Yeah, and well, two things. I thought you were going to share the story of your Alabama fan friend in Cabo who jumped in the pool
with his phone.
Wasn't he in the Crimson Tide Elephant?
Yes. Yes, he was.
I thought that's kind of where you were heading with that story. And then back to your initial premise, and that is, the talent is really spread throughout the country. Yes, the SEC has about double the draft picks of every other conference, but the Big Ten and the ACC and the Big 12 and the Pac-12 have talent that's dispersed kind of across the country. But the challenge, Mike, is because of those passions and because of the resources and the exposure, what's happened to the recruits out of the state of California? Have they stayed at USC? Have they stayed in the network of the conference and in the footprint of the conference? No. Some of the top recruits out of the state of Washington, are they going to stay? Well, they're going to go to Ohio State, and they're going to go to Florida, and they're going to go to Georgia, and they're going to leave this footprint because of that passion, that there's 80 to 100,000 people there, because of those resources, that they get everything and their stadiums are unbelievable, because people care so desperately and the boosters, give back and pay back.
So where does it end? I'll ask you the same question I asked Bruce Feldman. How does it end? What does this look like in another year or two?
In another year or two, I'm not going to say we're going to be to the point of the power conferences and the mega conferences, but we're getting there. Can you have 4 16 member power conferences out of these Power Five schools? There's a bunch of them that can barely sustain and hang on competitively. And you get to the point where you're just like, okay, it's almost regional. Here's your Midwest. Here's your South. Here's your North. And here's your West of the Rocky Mountains.
Let's say that happens. How many schools west of the Rockies remain at that level? You think all the schools in the Pac-12 remain at that level?
I think that's a fair question. I think that's probably a worthy debate. Yeah, I probably.
And I'm not looking to put you in trouble of taking shots at anybody's schools, but if that does happen, how many schools are in the Power Five conferences right now, all told?
I think there's about 75.
Okay, and in this, what you just said was about 64, right? You said 16 times 4. So in that scenario, 11 Power 5 teams drop out of what we currently consider to be major college football.
Yep.
Plus, don't forget, you still have Notre Dame and right? Is BYU still in a car? They're not, right? So, you might have to lose, let's say instead of, you have to lose 15 or 12 or 12 to 15 teams. Who are they?
Could you see 2 to 4 Pac-12 schools no longer able to keep up financially?
Yeah, I could. I mean, would it be a huge shock if all of a sudden Oregon State wasn't in anymore? And I don't say that as a shot at the Beavers fans, but for the decade that I've lived here, they've been largely irrelevant in any way, shape, or form. I know that they have a history, but does that end? Does UCLA give up?
At that point, it comes down to the dollars and cents. At that point, it probably comes down to what you're able to bring in at the gate.
I can't imagine Boston College sticks around in the ACC. No way.
What's that?
I can't imagine Boston College sticks around in the ACC.
Hey, watch it.
They'd be out. They didn't even want to be in the ACC. They only joined it for basketball. They wanted to be in the old Big East.
Yeah, I think you're going to get to the point where you're going to have super conferences. I think this the pandemic, the player empowerment, where this is going, I think it's going to just lead to that unlevel playing field.
But if
the house of cards has been a lot of this, the shifting sands that so much of college football, unfortunately, over the last 20 to 25 years is exposed, is I think eventually you're going to get to that level of symmetry, that those big dogs that can compete, that have the fan bases, that have the revenue, that have the money, that have the backing, that have the support to go for it and create those 4 mega super conferences.
Okay. Well, there are 4 mega super conferences. I'll say right here today, this week, what they will be. The ACC, the SEC, the Big 12, and the Big 10. Those will be your 4 super conferences. You think Larry Scott is going to outmaneuver the other commissioners to make one of the 4 the Pac-12?
Big 12's a bunch of podunk community college
Oklahoma.
Schools in the flyover
They have
states.
Oklahoma.
No one
I think
cares
the ACC
about the
has a lot of schools that, the Dukes in the Wake Forests that are really challenged to have 20,000 people show up at a game. I think the USC's, the Oregon's, the Washington's, the history of the UCLA, the tradition.
You're going to join the Big Ten.
What's that?
We'll join the Big Ten.
I think we'll have 4.
They would if they're smart. They should join the Big Ten if they're smart. Why would they want to stay in the Pac-12 with a rotten network and a rotten commissioner and everything else?
Because it's
when they go join
the
Big Ten.
Some of the best academics in the country. It's in San Francisco, Seattle,
yeah,
Portland,
Los
Angeles,
with the Big Ten, you get
Phoenix.
Michigan. You get decent academics
in some
places.
This was the problem when the Big 12 was going to come here. It's like Pac-12. Oh,
I didn't say Big 12. I said Big Ten.
Okay, so what? You're going to head to
Michigan.
East Lansing, Michigan?
Yeah.
Oh, man, that would be beautiful.
Well, I didn't say that it's
you could
beautiful.
Head to Purdue and Lafayette, Indiana.
Can you imagine what that's going to do to Kyle Brown's gas bill as he pulls his trailer to West Lafayette?
Yeah, Kyle, you're just worried about yourself having to drive there.
I mean, I'll go to Madison.
They took on Utah and Colorado. I think they can take on Michigan
they
and
Purdue.
They
took on Boulder and Salt Lake City. They took on some beautiful mountainous locales.
It's not about beauty and mountains.
Oh, it's all about beauty.
Well,
that's the only thing it is.
Then that's exactly why we are where we are.
This is Brock and Sox. Answer the question, jerk.
Keep asking questions. Come on, I'll answer them. Come on, I'm here. I'm going to answer your questions, dang it.
Answer my question! The question, jerk!
Well, don't just stand there. Answer the question, jerk!
We got so many questions on Twitter this week for this, man.
Can I just say thank you, Mike?
Oh, sure.
And seriously, thank
you're welcome,
you.
Brock.
Yes, you can. Why?
I mean, just a sincere, heartfelt, you know, you've told me you love me before and everything, and you feel like I don't reciprocate that, and
true.
Sometimes I'm awkward in that way. But last night, you know, lots of emotion, lots of things going on and in the college football world. As I said earlier, it's kind of been my lifeblood for a lot of years. And I reached out to you and said, hey, buddy, hey, little buddy. Would you mind just tweeting out some answer the question jerks? I really feel like
we needed it. Yeah.
And you were like, sure. And then you did. And people responded.
I know.
And it just, thank you for that.
I
thank you
in
for
my
not
mind,
saying, you, no, stupid idea.
Ever,
let's not do it. You're an idiot. People
like
don't like answer the question jerk on Twitter
question.
Anymore. No, you were a good friend.
All
so
right.
Thank you.
I'm here for you.
Next question.
We got a lot of questions, many from Aaron Gray's daughter.
Shout out to Aaron Gray's daughter.
Yes, huge shout out to her. Are you ready for some of hers?
Yes.
How do you feel about Reese Witherspoon?
What a career arc.
She has, right?
Wow. She has gone all over the place.
Cruel Intentions?
And all the way to, you know, the Longest Walk or whatever that was, where she did the Appalachian Trail.
Oh, yeah. That was not bad.
It wasn't bad.
I saw some of that.
She has had an all-over-the-place career, but you know what?
What?
She's on the list of actors for me that I think is the most like generally lovable actors in general. Like, I'm not bothered by Reese Witherspoon in virtually anything she does.
Isn't she in, whatchamacallit now, the show Big Little Lies?
Yes.
She's good in that.
Yeah.
I kind of confuse the idea of Reese Witherspoon with Drew Barrymore.
Oh, my.
I know they're different people.
No.
Yeah.
But the idea of them is sort of, they're caught up in my mind together.
I separate them. I separate them a little bit. To your point, Hottie, I would agree. I think Reese Witherspoon has done a huge range of movies. Very comfortable. I think very talented.
Yeah.
For some reason, maybe totally unfair and unjust, I think of her a little bit like Danica Patrick. I think she could be maybe not the nicest of persons. Like if you met her off screen, I don't know why I feel that way.
I don't think that's the vibe that came out of that Big Little Lies thing. I think everyone's sort of like she was the rallying force there. I think.
Oh, was she good?
I think so.
It may be totally unjust.
I might be
again.
Talking
love
with
to see it.
No, yeah, I don't know. I might be wrong.
Next question.
All right, let's see more from Aaron Gray's 14-year-old daughter. Tall houses or wide houses?
Oh,
wide.
See, so I grew
wide.
Up. I grew up tall house envy. I love tall houses. In fact, I wanted a 3-story house growing up just because I liked the idea of having a tall house. A
lot of stairs.
That's really more of a which is better question, but it's a good question. I'm going to go tall house. Being able to remove yourself and be on a different floor from, say, your kids is A+. Huge, huge win. Wide house, I don't know. I don't know that there's enough advantage to that.
It's more like a rambler. You know,
you can separate in a wide house. Just go to the other...
Nah,
side
you're on the
house.
Same floor. It's not the same.
It's a physical greater distance.
I know.
The equal square foot house,
actually
one story versus three.
Actually being separated by ceiling and floor, it feels totally different.
In a 5,000 square foot house that's 3 stories
true.
Versus 1 story, you're 5,000 feet apart if you're on opposite
you're
sides of the house.
You're arguably
farther
apart.
You are further apart in a 1-story house.
But it doesn't feel the same. It's about feel, though.
course, in Europe, Amsterdam, Copenhagen, you pay taxes by the width of your house. So they're all very skinny, but like five stories
tall.
Interesting.
That seems like a terrible, terrible
awful
system.
Mm-hmm. Very draconian.
What she also asks, what is your preferred thread count for bed sheets? I'll tell you, I recently bought new bed sheets, and I found out that it's not just about the thread count. Yeah, it's about the type of cotton.
Thread, yes.
Yeah, so it's Egyptian cotton, Pima cotton. Like, they're all different.
But each of those cottons have different thread counts, correct?
Well, no, no. The thread count in each cotton is different. But you have to determine which style of sheet you like. You have sateen, right? Like, you have the flannel.
You've got eggshell. You've got semi-gloss.
That's different.
Satin.
Different.
Things. Oh.
Yeah, I forget which one it is I like, but I had to find the sheets. I think it's Pima that I like. And I had to find the sheets
that I liked.
Mike.
Huh?
Do you like really soft sheets or crisp?
Kind of, it's hard to describe.
Pretentious elitist alert.
I like Pima.
I had to find my preferred cotton before identifying the best thread.
Wait, hold on. You don't want to go to
bed. Pima runs in a counterclockwise weave traditional to the Jordanian style. Now, whereas more of an Egyptian cotton is based off papyrus.
I like the Pima more than the Egyptian. That's all I'm saying.
You would.
Next question.
One last question from Aaron Gray's daughter. Delaney, by the way, her name. I met Brock at Costco one time. Why is he so tall?
Oh.
It's a good question.
Well, back to the Dutch part. The Dutch is based off height. Yes. He's taxed on his width.
His family line figured it out a long time ago.
Delaney, that is true. I think you got a point to Grandma Peg on that one. The Borlach family in Holland,
Bundesliga.
where Grandma Peg was born in Haarlem, the Netherlands. She brought the height, nearly 6 foot tall.
Next question.
This one's from Chris. You get to play one of these courses, St. Andrews, Pebble Beach, or Augusta, with one of these partners, Phil, Tiger, or Jordan Spieth. What combo are you going with, or are you going off the board?
Augusta with Tiger.
Off the board is now an option?
Yeah.
Augusta
or
with Tiger.
Did you any
chalky
of these options?
Here's some very specific options. Yep. Or you could choose any.
You'd go Tiger with Tiger at Augusta?
I would.
If I'm just sticking with these options, it would be Spieth, probably at St. Andrews, maybe at Pebble Beach. But St. Andrews.
The thing is, if St. Andrews or Pebble Beach, we could get them if we're willing to pay.
I know.
Wait.
I don't want to go.
Augusta, we can't get them.
I have no interest in playing Augusta.
Okay. Yeah, I'd go Phil, I think. Phil, I'd rather play Pebble, but given this, I mean, you have to choose Augusta, I think, because that's the only chance to get there.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you can just go play a Pebble. Do you want to go play that Harding course?
TPC Harding Park?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It looked beautiful. Those cypress trees were amazing.
And if you're San Francisco resident, like $50.
That's it?
You or I, like $150.
But it's the same as Chambers.
Yeah, it's reasonable.
It cost us $150 to go play Chambers.
Was that like can I ask a really dumb question? I wasn't listening that closely to the broadcast at times. Was that like a reservoir or lake or what was
Lake
that?
Merced. Lake Merced. Yeah.
Is that freshwater or saltwater?
I don't know. It was a really odd
fresh
color.
I'm pretty sure it's freshwater.
Yes.
Wasn't it a
Can
weird
ask
color?
Bob and C-Raj if that's freshwater or saltwater?
Yeah, that was a weird color.
It was a weird. It looked like the Puyallup River.
Is that a good thing?
No, not a little.
Is that a
muddy,
positive?
Little
just a
gloomy?
Muddy, sooty. Just
looks like it belonged in London. It was the River Thames on a cloudy, gloomy day in San Francisco. Yeah.
So that's Lake Merced.
Yes.
Huh?
Yes.
Interesting. I would never have, if you would have said, hey, what do you think Lake Merced looks like in the Bay Area? I would have never hit a million. If you gave me 10 pictures of Lake Merced in the Bay Area, that would have been number 10.
Yeah.
But the course was just stunning.
It was cool,
and you're right. Those cypress trees and the roots and the effect they played, even for those guys hitting into those trees, losing balls in the trees.
Yeah, I wonder how much easier it is if you're not playing from the tips, if a lot of those awful tee shots would become a whole lot.
Let's just say much
simpler.
Easier.
Yeah.
Yeah, much, much
easier. Well, I don't mean, obviously,
less
they'd
cared.
Be shorter. But
I could
just
still end up right. Trust me.
Bet you could.
Next question.
This comes from Mike. If you were forced to spend one evening with Bruce Arians, eating a meal that he personally cooked for you, what would you have him cook?
Something with paint.
Bourbon, just going to say, bourbon or paint?
With a big glass of paint right on the side.
Kudos to Bodie, who answered here online. A cake replica of the Super Bowl 48 Lombardi trophy. At least we can have the cake and eat it, too.
Put that thing right on my head as well. That'd be perfect.
Yeah, I couldn't come up with a good no excuses joke. I'm sorry. There were none available. There's no excuses food.
Do you think you could go to dinner? You think you could go to dinner with Bruce?
Yeah, I think so.
If you came to Ascend and you and him went up to Ascend.
I think so.
And had a little. I think actually you probably.
Salk could be like, that was amazing.
I mean, I managed to be in a room with Scott Brosius and not want to murder him, which I thought was like a huge step. I mean, when he was here as a Mariners coach, met
Paul O'Neill.
Really
could you do
nice
that
guy
with Paul O'Neill's
no,
face?
Let's not get carried away. Doing it with Scott Brosius was enough. Don't ask me to do it with Paul O'Neill. Gosh.
Next question.
All right, last one here from Bobby. For an able-bodied person, what is the minimum number of floors you have to go down before the use of the elevator is reasonable? Not up, but down.
Four?
So three, if you're on the fourth floor...
Two is out. You got to walk.
One floor for sure. You're on the second floor, you walk down. You're on the third floor...
You probably walk down. That's probably
it's
the
in
line.
A three and a half. Yeah.
I mean, if you got one of those tall houses, you have to do that anyway, unless you're Clayton.
Right. That all day. Yeah, Clayton.
Right. You got the elevator. Fourth floor. You're in the fourth floor of
I'm
your office building.
Elevator.
You're probably jumping in the elevator.
Yeah.
This office building, I got in a few weeks ago in our elevator for the very first time. Three-story building, never been in it, but we had to take like a cart up.
Huh.
But so have you ever been in here? Three stories.
What do you mean? In where?
Here, in our building where
I've
we were.
I've never been in the elevator.
Yeah, I got in for the first time.
I've never
time.
Been in the elevator.
Is it one of the old style where you have to like pump it up and pumping. Down?
We've actually been paying a bellhop there to operate the elevator.
It's the dog that sits. What's the dog's name who sits in there? Fucking floor. You know what I mean? What's the cartoon dog that sits in the elevator?
Like Droopy?
Droopy. Yeah. Is it Droopy? Is that his name?
Clifford?
Not Clifford. Clifford wouldn't be able to fit in there.
Rover?
All right. I think we're done for today. I think that's going to do it for us. We will be back next week. The Seahawks will be practicing, and so we'll obviously have quite a bit to say from there. We'll talk some Mariners maybe as well, and we'll see what else is going on in the world. Until then, Brock, it's been a lot of fun, but the hey.
And thank you, Delaney. You were the star of the show. Is in the button.
See everybody.
This is the chopper!